There's a story of a small plane with five passengers on it that had an engine malfunction, and it was going down. The pilot came out of the cockpit with a parachute pack strapped on his back and addressed the group. "Folks, there's bad news, and there's good news. The bad news is that the plane's going down, and there's nothing more I can do. The good news is that there are several parachute packs in the back of the plane by the wall. But more bad news is that there are four of them and five of you. Good luck. Thank you for choosing our airline, and we hope you have a good evening wherever your final destination may be." He then gave the group a thumbs-up sign and was out the door. A woman leaped up from her seat. "I'm one of the most prominent brain surgeons in the Northeast. My patients depend on me." She grabbed a pack, strapped it on her back, and leaped out. A man stood up. "I'm a partner in a large law practice, and the office would fall to pieces without me." And he grabbed a pack and strapped it on his back and leaped out. Another man stood up and said, "I'm arguably the smartest man in the world. My IQ is so high, I won't even tell you what it is. But surely you understand that I must have a parachute." And he grabbed a bundle and leaped out. That only left two people on the plane, a middle-aged pastor and a teenage boy. The pastor looked at the boy and sighed, saying, "You can take the last parachute. You're young. You have your whole life ahead of you. God bless you and safe landing." The teenager grinned and looked at the older woman. "Thanks, Pastor, but there are still two parachutes left. The smartest man in the world grabbed my backpack." Preaching Professor Alice McKenzie shares this joke to point to the importance of how we decide who or what we will stake our lives on will impact where we're going. There's much to lose, and there's much to gain. However, what looks like profit, according to the world's standards, may actually cause you to forfeit your life. A group of disciples followed Jesus around, clearly because they believed there was something to gain by following this man. But how? They couldn't quite figure out. We are all here because in some way, there's at least some part of us that wants to follow Jesus. But who is this man we say we follow? And how will his ways profit us? Before our daughter was born, Chris and I lived in a mid-rise apartment building in Chicago. Each day we were greeted by Phyllis, the security attendant in our building. From our first day, Phyllis always greeted Chris and me with warmth and welcome, often sprinkling our chats with bits of local lore or gossip. She gave us updates on neighborhood developments and cheered us on as we each updated her on the new jobs we had just started in Chicago. And when Phyllis found out I was working as a minister, it opened up a whole new dimension to how we related. In most company, announcing what I do for a living can sometimes be a conversation stopper, but not for Phyllis. Phyllis loved God and always seemed in search of a deeper spirituality. She spent the early afternoons, which were very quiet in our building, in Bible study and in prayer each day. She loved going to church and often told me about her spirit-filled church that she attended with her niece. And she avidly read literature on spirituality and would often share her latest reading with me. Every time she showed me a book, she would say, "Surely you know of this author. He's written lots of good books on the faith." I'm afraid I disappointed her each time. I had not read any of her books. "Oh, well," she'd say, "just pray for me that I get on the right track." I told her I'd pray for her and asked that she pray for me too. Because our style of talking about faith was not always the same, for instance, I'd not read the spirituality books Phyllis had read, and I didn't tend to sprinkle much God talk into my everyday conversation. And while spirit-filled at Phyllis's church often meant speaking in tongues and faith healings, in my church, spirit-filled meant a nice, quiet moment in worship. It sometimes made me feel uncomfortable that I might not fit into Phyllis's image of who or what a minister should be. I imagined her ministers didn't look or talk like me, and these assumptions may have been completely unfair. And even if my assumptions were accurate, they should never prevent us from having meaningful and friendly conversation. After all, Phyllis continued to be genuine, to be warm, even as I remained suspicious about whether I would measure up to the image she would have as a minister. I imagine some of you may have the same problem in the faith. You worry about whether you measure up to perceived notions of what a Christian ought to be. Or perhaps you make assumptions which are not necessarily fair about what and who Christianity represents. When I'm out at parties or socializing, sometimes when I share I'm a minister, I notice a change in how people talk to me. They apologize for the curse words they just said, and the drink in their hands starts to disappear. Then they try and figure out how I can be a minister and be a woman, and be married, and be gay. And eventually, they may drift to other parts of the room for conversation with someone else. They have an assumption about what Christianity represents, and they figure they do not fit in, or maybe I don't. Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" Jesus knew how to warm up a conversation. I have often found that when speaking to people about something that is of deep personal meaning, it is easier to get them talking about what other people think than directly asking, "What do you think?" For instance, in my work with teenagers in youth ministry, I've had more success asking questions like, "What kinds of things do people at your school get bullied for?" Or, "What ideas do your friends have about Christianity?" And asking direct things like, "Has anyone ever bullied you?" Or, "What does Christian faith mean to you?" Once they open up about the less invasive question of what other people are doing or thinking, there's a chance they may open up then about themselves more personally. As for Jesus' disciples, they had a few answers. Some say you are John the Baptist. Others say you're Elijah. Still others, one of the prophets. Each of these answers was something worth staking their life on. John the Baptist, who just a couple of chapters earlier in Mark, gets killed off by Herod by beheading, would have made quite a splash because his appearance would have involved the resurrection of someone who had just recently been politically assassinated, saying that though the state had killed him, he and his message had in fact lived. That's excellent foreshadowing. Elijah's return, according to the book of Malachi, would bring forth the great and terrible day of the Lord, a kind of final judgment when God will come down with a refining fire to bear witness against those who oppress the hired workers in their wages, the widow and the orphan, against those who thrust aside the alien and do not fear the Lord, as the book of Malachi said. And this prophet would reward those who had been faithful to God. We know that the prophets courageously stood their ground in the face of powerful rulers as they spoke a bold word that inspired conversion of people, of rulers, and of nations. Clearly, Jesus' ministry had created enough buzz in the land that people were associating him with the great names of the tradition and looking toward what he will bring forward next. But it's Peter who names Jesus as the Messiah, It would seem that Peter is like the child who gets the point of the children's sermon before the pastor reaches the punchline. No wonder Jesus ordered Peter not to say anything about it. Jesus needed more time for the truth of who he was and what he was doing to unfold. And let's be real, the Jewish concept of the Messiah was of a powerful king who would achieve a final peace through military might, because all the nations would fear him. And to call Jesus, the wandering peasant preacher, a Messiah would have been a huge irony, to say the least. More than a Messiah, Jesus looked like Isaiah's version of the suffering servant. In four passages of poetry within Isaiah, we see this character of the suffering servant emerge. In our passage from today, we hear that the suffering servant is beaten. His beard, the badge of his masculinity, is plucked away, and he is insulted and spit upon. All of these actions are meant to cause public shame. However, the speaker knows they have God on their side. Who can shame them? Who can cause disgrace? The only one in the court of judgment whose opinion actually matters has chosen the servant's side. As for the others, all of them will wear out like a garment. The moth will eat them up. Likewise, Jesus predicts to Peter and to the disciples that Jesus will go through great suffering, rejection, and even execution. This is not the Messiah anyone expected. How can you say such things? Peter demanded. But Jesus called to the crowd, warning them that following him will require loss. And then this paradox: those who will save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? If we are looking at today's standards of profit and gains, profit with an F, not PH like the prophet Isaiah, following Jesus seems rather silly. But God's vision is so much bigger than what we can see by the limitations of today's standards of reward. It is a long view. It is a faithful view. And it is a view that offers life, not just for some far-off promise of the glories of heaven, but something that offers life today, a life that is really worth living, because it is a life of meaning, a life of purpose, and a life that is shared so that others may have life too. Our task as Christians is not to try to fit into the mold of who other people say Jesus is. In Mark's gospel, the disciples echoed other people's assumptions about Jesus, that he was John the Baptist, Elijah, some other prophet. Our task as Christians is to name from the heart who we say Jesus is. The truth is, Jesus would rather that we name who he is in our lives than to follow someone else's assumption of who he is. Jesus can be the one who enjoys a good party and can speak to a security attendant while she spends the quiet afternoon hours flipping through prayer magazines. And Jesus can be present with a confused disciple. And Jesus can be embodied in you. Who do you say that Jesus is? And what will you risk to witness to him in your life? Let us wonder. Amen.